Community Blood Services of Illinois, the nonprofit agency providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston, Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers are for the program Harriet Williamson, Travis Danzel, Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with journalist, writer, producer Nick Ryan. He's written for a number of publications, The New York Times Magazine, The Guardian, Wired, The South China Morning Post, The Australian, The Irish Times, The Scotsman. And we'll be talking about a book that he's authored that's the product of several years that he spent talking with and getting to know people in the extreme right of politics, particularly in Europe, but also he spent some time talking with people here in the United States. His book is titled Into a World of Hate, A Journey Among the Extreme Right. Routledge is the publisher. He's also been involved as creative producer for England Expects, a recent BBC drama on the extreme right. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and we'll talk about some of his experiences, how he got involved in this reporting project, and some of the things that he learned. And of course, questions are welcome here on the program as well. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call would be 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. So if you'd be listening around Illinois and Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel, or if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Ryan, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
That's no problem. How are you?
We certainly appreciate it. Good. Thank you. And yourself?
Yes, very well. Thanks.
Good. Just to start, I'd like to have you talk about how it is that you got into this, got started on this project, and it sounds as if it was a little, perhaps a little indirect. Certainly you didn't start out with this idea that what you wanted to do was an investigation of the extreme right.
Well, yeah, that's right. In many ways, the project took on a life of its own, kind of sucked me in, I guess, by the end of it. It started out fairly innocuously. I was traveling among what I would call new religious movements, environmental protest groups, people involved in paganism, people basically involved in kind of subcultures here in Britain. As a result of doing that, I was looking at people who in the end would end up on the outside of society, who would reject society. And those people here in the UK, at least in my opinion, were groups like football hooligans, soccer hooligans. So it's through my interest in following soccer hooligans that I came into contact with the extreme right. Those two worlds tend to be linked. There's a lot of shared interest, for example, in Northern Ireland. So I was really looking to write a book on these subcultures. And then as a result of that, and looking at these soccer hooligans, I moved into that world of the extreme right. Mm.
And you did that. Different people have done this kind of work and done it in different sorts of ways. Some people have posed as people who were interested in joining, and some people have gone in, and I think in a very open way, and said, well, look, I'm a journalist, I'm a reporter, I just want to find out what you people think, what you believe, and to write something about you. And then that's what you did. You didn't tell them anything that wasn't perfectly true, that you were interested in learning about them and writing about them.
Well, yeah, I mean, my approach was really that of a personal journey. I mean, there is quite a lot of me in this story. It's not really an analysis or a historical document. It's the story of my journey into what I think is a hidden world, something that lurks underneath in many Western societies. And you're right, yes, I went in fairly openly. What I didn't tell these people was the help I was having from left-wing activists, from civil rights activists in the States, here in Europe, people who were helping me understand really something about the nature of these kind of groups, whom I should contact. So in the UK, there's a group called Searchlight, which is an anti-racist organization. They very much helped me, helped introduce me into a gang over here that was called Combat 18, which some of your listeners may have heard that name. It's the 1 and 8 in their name stands for the initials A and H in the alphabet, Adolf Hitler's initials. And the idea was Combat 18 was it was a kind of a soccer hooligan group that was also working for the main extreme right party, political party in Britain during the 1990s. So Searchlight, this anti-racist organization, were following the group's activities. They actually passed addresses and names of group members to me. I then approached those members as myself, and through that got access into that world.
Mm-hmm. I think you point to one of the things that does make your book a little different than some of the others that I have seen, and in the sense that it's not an academic analysis, and it's not really straight journalism. It's something a little bit different, and it does you do include your personal reflections, your reactions to the people that you met. And there is maybe a little bit more of you in this than there would be in other kinds of, I guess I use the word, a more straight kind of journalistic approach.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, perhaps some people will accuse me of having a too large an ego, but that's just an approach I felt I wanted to do. And I'm somebody who reads, for example, George Orwell stuff or Jack London. Those kind of approaches appeal to me, that reportage in amongst the thick of it, sometimes yourself included, oneself included. But the reportage is very much telling you something deeper. So, I mean, at the end of the day, a book like mine, I think, is all about identity. But on a page-by-page basis, what it is the story of my journey deeper and deeper into this world and the kind of strange and amazing things which come up, not just the violence and the physical threats. For example, the gang I mentioned, Combat 18, dissolved into feuding and murder during the 15 months that I was encountering the members, but also as I befriended and won the trust of different extremists, first in Britain and then overseas, I was able to live with people. Lived with a guy in Washington, D.C., for example, a British extremist who then, it turned out, had links to extremist groups all the way from your kind of low-level skinhead up to and including pseudo-intellectual Holocaust deniers with then links into the Middle East. So those kind of networks are shown through my own journeys as I physically travel those networks. Mm.
Maybe you might talk a little bit more about Combat 18 and the kind of people that belong to this group. And I guess one of the things that I'm interested in is whether you felt that they had some kind of real complex thought out political ideology. Could you really have engaged them in a kind of a conversation about what it was they believed and why? And one might well disagree with that, but at least you could get some, they would tell you what it was that they thought and why. Or was it more the case that it's that what drives them is even harder for them to understand and talk about?
Well, I'd say Combat 18 was very brutal, very tribal. I think that comes across in the writing. I mean, one of the first scenes I'm describing is the murder trial of the guy who was then the leader, a guy by the name of Charlie Sargent. And the world these people inhabit, it certainly was then. It was a bit, I guess, like a biker gang or a criminal gang. They were making actually quite a lot of money out of the sale of illegal white power music CDs, the stuff that's illegal here. It's not necessarily illegal in the States, but it's illegal over here under our race relations laws. And that was as important to them, making the money, being a power on the projects and the estates, on the streets, as any wider ideology. Now, having said that, there were a few individuals within that group and others like them stateside as well, who do have a sort of more defined ideology, a quite virulent white supremacist ideology. And you'll find even a very subcultural gang like that through the use of things like the internet or reading books written by key individuals in the extreme right, they will take on board that ideology. For example, anti-Semitic beliefs, also beliefs about how you can construct a race war, how you can attack members of minority communities, hoping to instigate some sort of backlash against whites by that minority and thereby stoke up racial tensions. So on an individual level, you often won't find that the members can really elucidate any deep opinion, but one or two can, and those one or two have and will take it to the extremes. Mm-hmm.
And also, I think one of the points that you make is that it is not uncommon in groups like this for them to fight among themselves almost as much as they fight with the people that they consider their opponents. And in this particular case, the group fell apart because there was this struggle over who would be the leader of the group.
That's right. Again, I mean, in some ways, depending on your political point of view, of course, but in some ways you could take comfort from that kind of thing and think, yes, okay, if you walk down a dark alleyway and these guys find you, you might have trouble. Other than that, perhaps they're misfits and weirdos. And some of that does come out through my writing. I mean, again, through their own actions. I mean, you had lots of guys living on their own. And in the book, if it's about anything, is also about men, people who are looking for a sort of a moment of power in their lives. However, on the other hand, you know, these guys are only one part of a bigger picture. That's something I discovered as I was journeying around for 6 years over Europe and in the States, that these groups fit into a much wider network. And in some ways, it's what they represent that's also dangerous. My own opinion is the rise of the extreme right, as well as the rise, as we have here in Europe, of quite xenophobic anti-immigrant sentiments. It's part of a changing, you know, shape of society, really, almost a flip side to Al-Qaeda, as we're worried about the East. Here in the West, we've got potentially the enemy within.
Let me introduce again our guest in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Nick Ryan. He is an award-winning writer and producer. He's written for a number of publications. He's the author of the book Into a World of Hate, A Journey Among the Extreme Right. It's published by Routledge. He was also producer for a drama, using that as a way of telling the story of the extreme right, one that was produced and aired recently on the BBC. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. What sort of relationships are there, connections are there between groups like C-18 and people who work in the more visible above ground world of electoral politics, thinking of in Britain, but there are other kinds of connections between similar kinds of groups elsewhere in Europe, I think, too.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because here in Europe we've had the rise of the far right as a political force. In Britain, it's still quite stunted. There's a group here called the British National Party, known as the BNP, which has some seats in local town councils at the moment, but nothing else. But if you travel across the water into France, for example, the National Front in France, the Front National, regularly gets about 5.5 million votes in the presidential elections. Or in Austria, you had a far-right party rising there. In Belgium, right across the continent, basically around somewhere between 10 to 25% of voters in many countries are voting for extreme-right political parties. Now, what happens is, as those parties rise, and again, I saw this myself, they try and get rid of the militants from the past. They try and get rid of the associations with the Sieg Heiling, with the brown shirts, with the swastikas. And often you'll find like gangs like Combat 18 and their brethren who've spread over in places like Germany, for example. There is that youth rebellion element. People want to lash out against something. They want to have their tattoos, the violence, the drinking, the camaraderie. It's only a very few number of those that actually stay within those movements and progress onwards. But those people become an embarrassment to the more successful political movements. The successful political movements don't want to be associated with that image of thuggery. They want to appeal to working class men and women, middle class people. Well, ironically, you actually find, certainly here in Britain, the British National Party, for example, its main constituent, its main support base, is white working class males, age 18 to 35 who normally don't vote for anybody. They don't participate. So the rise, if you like, of the political extreme right is very much a protest vote. And on the flip side, when I was in the US, I was traveling with British extremists who were working with US extremists to try and build that kind of political far-right power base that at the moment you don't have.
Well, that's one of the, I suppose, on the one hand, people might say that certainly groups like this can be dangerous in isolated instances, but that their numbers are small enough so that as individual groups, perhaps, we don't need to worry about what it was that, what it is they could possibly do. Now, having said that, though, I think what does concern people is the fact that groups like this have attempted to network with one another and in that sense enlarge their possibilities for action, for violent acts. And that is something certainly that does seem to concern people. To what extent do you think that actually has taken place, that the different groups perhaps operating in different countries have managed to establish relationships with one another?
To quite a great extent, actually. I mean, for example, the leader of the party I was just talking about, the British National Party, he's a close friend of David Duke, who many people will have heard of in the US, the former KKK leader who turned himself into a politician. He's also our leader here, the BNP leader. He's been over to Germany to meet a former left-wing terrorist who was a founder member of something called the Baader-Meinhof gang, which in the 1970s was carrying out attacks in Germany. And then the guy called Horst Mahler switched his political position and became a member of the extreme right, which sounds odd, but perhaps that's where the extremes meet. You've got something called the Institute for Historical Review, which is based on the West Coast over there, that organizes itself around the issue of Holocaust denial, or as they call it, Holocaust revisionism. That links them, that issue, that basically anti-Semitic issue, links them with dozens of groups around the globe, not just in the extreme right, but with Muslim radicals as well. So that in 2001, for example, I was invited out to Beirut for a conference of Islamic radicals and extremely right-wing Westerners, pseudo-intellectual Westerners, to debate the issue of the Holocaust. Of course, you've got the internet, you've got books, you've got email groups. There's a well-known website called Stormfront, which is operated out of Florida by a friend of David Duke's. And that Stormfront, for example, is used to swap ideas, facilitate information. And of course, you've got the ideology of being a lone wolf, or the ideology of something called leaderless resistance, which is kind of like terrorism, having small cells of people operate autonomously in different parts of the country so that if one cell is infiltrated, the rest will be protected. All those kind of things all sort of facilitate these networks. So, yes, you'll find people talking to one another, physically meeting. I mean, I even went to a conference of something called the Council of Conservative Citizens. They had a conference in North Carolina when I was over there. It was very much like it was in a Holiday Inn. It was very similar to going to any business conference. People in suits with conference badges and leather pads. But of course, the issues they're talking about, revolve around white supremacy. It's a more sophisticated form of white supremacy than a bonehead gang, but it's still white supremacy.
Hmm. Well, if I guess one of the things I find myself wondering is if we went out, say in London, we went out on the street and we started engaging people about in conversation about their political beliefs. That while we might, if we asked them about the agenda of a very hardcore white supremacist organization like C-18, for example, my guess is that maybe people would say no, that they would not support those ideas, that we're wrong. But I wonder if we could take it and if we just made it a little bit milder, if we watered it down to just a little bit, but essentially it contained some of the same kind of beliefs about race issues, about immigrants, about economic issues. Would we then find ourselves getting much more agreement with your person on the street to those kinds of positions?
short answer, yes. Here in the UK, we just had a whole series of elections for people to join the European Parliament. It was right across the continent. We also had our local city elections, as well as the elections in London for the representatives there. We had a party called the UK Independence Party take 12 seats in the European Parliament, 732 seats in total right across the EU. This party took 12 seats, and they've got a message which says Britain must leave the EU and immigration, in effect, must be drastically reduced. So they are a kind of sort of British National Party in suits, the respectable version. You just travel over here on the continent to Belgium, where I've been many times. Belgium is the heart of the EU. It's where NATO is. It's where the EU's headquarters are. And it has a reputation, and certainly in Britain and some other countries in Europe, as also being the heart of bureaucracy, quite a sleepy place full of bureaucrats. That said, Belgium has one of the largest extreme-right political movements on the continent. It's got a party called the Flemish Bloc, which represents the Flemish people, the people of northern Belgium who speak Dutch. Around a quarter, 25% of the Flemish people support this party. One of this party's main aims is to repatriate foreigners, or as they call them, non-integrating aliens, from their soil. Now, this is a very rich part of Europe. This is a sophisticated, multilingual part of Europe. You know, this is right in the heart of the EU. At the same time, you've also got Jews in the historic city of Antwerp, which is Belgium's second city, voting for that far-right party over fears of attacks by young North African Muslims. So you've got an extremely complicated picture of confused identity, if you like. And all this is really a byproduct of many issues affecting the world today. Some people might say globalization. But there's many, many, many issues causing the world to change faster, pull apart. And so you've got the rise of these single-issue groups, whether they are gangs, whether they are Al-Qaeda, whether it's extreme right. So in my opinion, that's what's going on.
We have a caller. I'd like to bring them into the conversation, someone listening in Champaign. So we will do that right now on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I just find this topic a bit overwhelming, so I'm not sure I'll make a clear question. But you mentioned something about Al-Qaeda, and I get the impression you're saying that in some ways these groups are copycats, and in other ways they may be responding to a terrorist threat or, you know, some sense of whatever, immigration, otherness, different culture, different religion, being a threat, which happens to be what's going on both sides. But I'm wondering if you can talk about, I think when this program was announced, the word something like politics of hate or hate groups came up, and I'm just wondering about, you know, I mean, sometimes when we think of religion, we think of love, maybe naively, and that's a bit different in actual practice in maybe Christian and many Muslim societies. But I'm just wondering if you can talk more about this call for violence, maybe sometimes coming from biblical sources or, you know, this kind of really kind of warrior approach. Does it have to do with threats, economic threats, that are causing these kind of religious and militant discourses?
I think there's many different questions in there and many answers. I mean, in some senses, when I talk about being the flip side to Al-Qaeda, one can talk about copycat to some extent, but really I'm talking on a metaphorical level. I think there's a perception, particularly in more insular parts of the West and of each of our countries. Here, for example, in England, it's often in the Northwest, there were race riots here 3 years ago, between young Asian men of Pakistani origin and white English. These were people both at the kind of bottom of the pile. And you could argue that's about economic resources, lack of jobs, lack of housing. On the other side, you have got people in extreme right movements who do see themselves, perhaps not as terrorists, but as freedom fighters. They even claim they love their race. They would say a classic liberal like me, as they would like to castigate me. You know, must hate your own race, want to see yourself bred out of existence. And there is a subsect of Christianity, or probably a heresy is a better word, called Christian identity, mm-hmm. which might be what you're referring to, I don't know, but I spent time down in Arkansas living with a Christian identity minister. That's included in one of the chapters of my book, and I describe being with him, being in his house, and hearing the stuff he espouses and believes. And he would say that regular Christians have got it all wrong, and that the Bible sanctifies, in effect, what I call race hate, that Jews, in his and his followers' beliefs, are Satan's children. Literally, that's what they believe. That the white man, and it always seems to be men in this case, not the white person, the white man has some kind of spirit which other races don't have. These other races are mud people. They selectively quote parts out of the scriptures to support race slaying. I mean, there's even a term, they call it the Phineas priesthood, which refers to a Israelite hero called Phineas who slew a fellow Israelite sleeping with a non-Israelite tribeswoman. And that's recounted in the early part of the Bible. But so, yeah, there are justifications for everything. And of course, this is very dangerous. I mean, over here in London, in 1999, there was a guy called David Copeland who set off a series of nail bombs, killing 3 people and wounding more than 100 in ethnic minority areas of London. He used as his justification partly this Christian identity belief or heresy. And we know from his police interview notes that he'd visited the website of the guy I then went out and spent time with in Arkansas. So again, it's a strange, introverted world, and it's definitely a world of men, very much so. There are some women, but it's definitely male-dominated.
Well, I guess that would be interesting to discuss in terms of feminism, but we probably don't want to get into that. But I'm just wondering, so at the same time, though, you have people who believe in the rapture, and if the Jews are to convert, then, you know, they'll be okay. And then in Europe, maybe in France, people might say, well, it's not race, it's a question of culture. And it seems that there are do you have a sense that this is all coming into one or going in one stream or one direction, or is there something positive about some divisiveness within this, or are you just looking at the very extreme.
Well, I mean, I start this. This is a very personal journey, and when I started it, the book's journey is beginning the fall of 1996. I didn't really have an idea of what I was going to find. Really, I was only looking at one area, like I said, soccer hooligans. The rest of the journeys through these networks, from lone wolves to neo-Nazi gangs to wider political movements, evolved quite organically. So the picture was always changing. I had no idea some of these parties would then be taking nearly 30% of the vote in a country. And again, it's not static. It's still changing. Like I mentioned, in Belgium, you recently, for example, a Jewish kid was stabbed by some Moroccan youths, and you've had thousands of Jews taking to the streets over that. You've had examples of both Jews and Muslims in Belgium voting for this extreme right party, which obviously seems a little nonsensical. But for lots of complex reasons, these things happen. And in my opinion, there are a whole lot of threads as to why you've got the rise of extremism of all different kinds at this moment in time.
Well, I'm just wondering, like, I mean, I would find your journey very scary and very creepy. What motivates you to go on? I mean, it seems to me like you're even putting yourself in a certain danger by now saying, well, I went in and I talked to all these people and I was kind of supported by left-wing people to go and find out about this. So it seems that you really have a strong belief that this is something that needs to be talked about or needs to be explored.
Well, I mean, in Britain, as you probably know, we've got a reputation for this so-called ironic humor. There's a lot of satirists, humorists, writers, and sometimes documentary makers who will look at a subject like this. I don't know if they do it with Islam, to be honest, but certainly with white supremacy, white nationalism, whatever terms you want to give it. They would look at this and then they would satirize it. And that works very well for a British audience. And that's one approach you can take. Another approach, of course, is you want to do the sort of undercover routine, dress up and pretend to be one of them. Or occasionally you have people who've come out of these movements and then write their accounts. I didn't really have any fancy notions when I started out. I just wanted to write what I saw. You know, some of my favorite writers, including people like Charles Dickens or whatever, or Graham Greene, the novelist, I think have written their best stuff based on what they've seen in real life. I think even Hemingway said words to that effect about his fiction coming out of real life. So that's just what propels me, and I hope I've made the writing quite accessible by being a personal journey. I mean, I don't know what the end result of all this is going to be. In 1928, I think the Nazi Party had about 2.5% of the vote in Germany, and in 1933, Hitler was in power. I don't necessarily think we're going to see that. What I do think we're going to see, it with the sort of increase in voter apathy, you're going to see the rise of these single-issue movements coalescing around one or two issues. And certainly here in Europe, immigration, and immigration linked to the idea of terrorism and Islam, is something very, very high on the agenda. It's something like number two or three out of people's top 10 voting concerns.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I need to reintroduce our guest and also do a little weather information here for people who are listening. We'll talk more with our guest Nick Ryan in just a moment. I do want people to know, though, that the Storm Prediction Center has issued a tornado watch for parts of northern and central Illinois that will be in effect until 5 o'clock today. And that includes the possibility of tornadoes, of hail, thunderstorm winds over 80 miles an hour, and dangerous lightning. That's all possible in the area. That's what the watch means, that there's possibility of those storms. And in our immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the tornado watch includes these counties in Illinois: Champaign, Ford, Vermilion, DeWitt, and Piatt. So do keep in mind that a tornado watch means conditions are favorable for tornadoes and severe storms in and close to the watch area. Now's the time to think about what you would do if a tornado or severe thunderstorm was headed your way. Keep aware of the changing weather and stay tuned here to AM 580 for the latest weather information. Again, this is a tornado watch in effect for parts of northern and central Illinois until 5 o'clock this afternoon. And we will keep you informed as we move through the day here of the weather. Our next opportunity to tell you about that will be as part of the afternoon magazine. That should be at 12:35. And also, I'd like to introduce again our guest. We're talking with writer Nick Ryan. He's written for a number of different publications, New York Times Magazine, The Guardian, Wired, others. In 1999, he received a special commendation from the International Federation of Journalists for his investigative reporting. And he has authored a book that's titled Into a World of Hate, A Journey Among the Extreme Right. It's published by Routledge. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I did mention a little bit earlier that you served as a consultant for a drama that was produced by the BBC that dealt with some of these same themes, a program, and I think that it aired fairly recently, England Expects. And I'm just a little curious about what the reaction to the film was.
Yeah, that's a long-term project, that was. It started in August of 2000, and it's only people like the BBC, really, that will try and tackle these divisive issues in fairly gritty, socially realistic terms. So I was already in the midst of my journeys for my book. I got called in by the producer, the eventual producer of that program, and we discussed lots of different storylines and ideas. And eventually I worked with a scriptwriter who's an Irish guy who's done a lot of work actually in Hollywood as well. We went together and we actually met people in Combat 18, people in this British National Party. We observed East London, where the drama was set. And East London is the East End, basically, is a fascinating area. It's actually going to be the subject of my second book, but I won't go into that at the moment. But that has a huge history of immigration. The last 500 years, it's been an area where immigrant communities come, they settle. Eventually, they make their money and move on out. So it was a very famous Jewish area for a long time. Now it's a center of Islam in the UK and also in Europe. It has one of Europe's largest Muslim centers and mosques, literally only about a mile away from the heart of the city of London. So it's a place where worlds collide. And what we did was we set the story of a guy called Ray Knight, who was a security guard working in the heart of the city for a city bank, And what happened to him is he saw his world deconstruct around him. And by doing that, we were showing how the extreme right, the political movements of the extreme right, how they attract people in, how they seek to offer simplistic answers to complex problems, just as Hitler did in the 20s and 30s. And, it was a very powerful drama. It was a two-hour-long film. And we did get a lot of hostile reaction as well as a lot of positive reaction.
Well, we have some other folks here to talk with. Let's go to Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. First of all, I wanted to tell the guest that I think his work is just really valuable, really interesting. And I had two questions. One is a follow-up on the last caller. I was curious, and this you might not want to talk about it, but it seems like it would be really difficult to come face-to-face with people who have so much hate over and over again, and I wonder how maybe you negotiated that as you were working. And just to be with people who are so angry and hateful. And the other question I had was, what do you feel like the conditions are which bring people to use hate as a problem, a solution for problems? And if you think that the people who do that, if they understand that their own situation, do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
To answer the first part, and again, as I've mentioned, this is a personal journey. There are times when I've tried to share with the reader what I was feeling. Certainly, as the journey has progressed and the events seem to speed up, life seemed to speed up around me. It was quite hard sort of maintaining a semblance of sanity. And I was spending a long time away from home with people who had very different views to myself. And I only really noticed some of those changes when I was with the writer. In fact, of that the drama we were just talking about, England Expects, I took him with me to a festival, an extreme right festival. That was taking place in Wales, in the rural depths of Wales. And I was just listening and watching the events. And to me, it was all par for the course. I'd heard the language of this sort of stuff about where the white man must go, this kind of thing. I didn't react to it, whereas my colleague was silently appalled, couldn't believe what he was hearing. And I realized I'd, in some ways, become hardened to it, I guess. I just hadn't questioned it. And also, you do end up relating to people on a one-to-one basis. You've got to spend time with them and talk with them. On some level, you find everyone, bar genuine psychopaths, will talk and empathize to a certain degree. And I still even know one or two people from those movements who will still talk to me despite knowing what I've written. So it's kind of strange. You end up questioning where your own beliefs lie, and also actually criticizing some of the kind of liberal beliefs that I've been brought up with. The conditions to bring hate, I presume you're talking there about, you've got different reasons why people will want simple answers. But I think that you've got a whole bunch of things going on where people I spoke to, they feel that the pace of life is increasing. They feel lost. They feel they've got job insecurity, that they feel there's this sense of being swamped, at least over here. This is a language of the newspapers often. People are being swamped by asylum seekers, refugees, immigrants. They mix these terms up. They're scared of these vague things like Islam and Al-Qaeda. And often I think they want simple answers. Perhaps what they really need to be dealing with is other issues, like their issues of their housing or their jobs. But these demagogic figures are coming along and promising them simple answers. And, it's a time-honored theory of blaming the other with a big O, something else. In the past, it was the Jews. I mean, ironically, I've found members of the extreme right, different groups I've met, dealing with Muslim extremists against sharing an interest against Jews. So they'll often share an opinion that the events of 9/11 were caused by some kind of Zionist conspiracy. Then on the flip side, you've got Islamophobia arising, where people are lashing out against Muslims or against Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Arabic neighbors, presuming they're somehow linked with Al-Qaeda. So it's an incredibly confusing time, and I think as the Chinese proverb goes, may you live in interesting times. It sounds like a curse probably, but I think people are looking for very simplistic answers. Maybe it's a natural human reaction. They don't want to deal with the complex gray world we really live in.
And do you imagine that it might have something to do with what's available for people? I mean, you said that the demagogic figures show up. I mean, if maybe there was a different kind of education or, you know, so people could maybe have more of a subtle opinion of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's an age-old question, isn't it? Why, you know, I don't know what the figures are now in the U.S., but is it less than half of the eligible population now vote? Why do people not vote? Why do they not want to engage? What's going wrong in politics? That's one big issue. And as I said before, I think you've got the rise of single issue protest movements. You certainly have over here. You've got the whole, if you like, the anti-capitalist strain, which sucks in a myriad of different groups from left to right and religious organisations. So you've had demonstrations about the war in Iraq in London, where you've got, you know, fairly woolly-minded liberals along with, you know, Muslim militants sharing the same podium. So that's the world we live in at the moment.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to another Urbana caller. This would be line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Besides the hatred that these people in a group have for, you know, other races, are there other religious beliefs that tie them together? I'm thinking particularly, you know, there are New Age religions that actually may not profess hate, but sometimes they're kind of maligned, you know, by the far right. But I'm wondering, did you see much in the way of religion also playing a role in these groups?
Yes, to a certain extent. I mean, it's quite well known, isn't it, that Hitler and his coterie had all sorts of interests in pagan and occultic beliefs. And, for example, I met guys in gangs like Combat 18 who had pagan beliefs, Odinist beliefs. Those seem very popular, the sort of, I suppose you'd call it neo-Norse revival. If you look on the far-right websites, if you look on their website selling music, for example, White Power Music, there seems to be quite an association with that image of the sort of warrior, lightning, Thor, this kind of stuff. Having said that, as I mentioned, certainly in the U.S., there is this sort of heretical Christian cult called Christian Identity, which I understand has somewhere in the region of 50,000 members. There's a very good civil rights group based in Chicago called the Center for New Community, which studies this kind of thing. So they may have some more figures on that kind of stuff. And they've done a lot of work combating the militia issue in the Midwest. And certainly the militias in the past seem to have quite a strong tie to the Christian Identity movement. But you've got a myriad of different beliefs. There's the East Peoria-based, or former East Peoria-based, World Church of the Creator. You may have covered this issue on your station, but mm-hmm. Matt Hale, who self-styled Pontifex Maximus of that neo-Nazi cult, was recently jailed for trying to have a federal judge killed. I visited Hale at his house, that's in one of the chapters, with somebody helping me from the Center for New Community. And Hale and his adherents had this belief in something called the White Man's Bible, which a cut-down version simply states that your race is your religion. And so you've got these kind of little cultlets and pseudo-religions cropping up, all means of justifying an end. I think often people start with their belief, whether it's race or religious hate or whatever it might be, and then seek other forms of justification.
So the religious aspect really kind of helped hold these groups together, would be...
Yeah, it does. I mean, just as there are many of these groups with different kinds of paganistic beliefs, for example, there are others who believe nothing, literally nothing. That some of the neo-Nazi groups in particular are quite antithetical to any form of religious belief. So one of the biggest groups in the States has been the National Alliance, and that was run by a guy called William Pierce, who was a former physics professor. Pierce is now dead, but that group, the National Alliance, had tentacles right across the states, and back into Europe through many different means. And Pierce invented something called cosmotheism, which is, again, another pseudo-religion, but it was very anti-Christianity. But yes, it can be part of the glue. I mean, the ideology, it has to include something about race in it. And in many ways, these groups like nothing better than dealing with extremists and other groups as well. So many of them have dealt with the Nation of Islam, for example, because they like to see that African Americans or blacks in Europe all belong to a kind of a block, a separate block that they can separate out, and then the white man can sit somewhere else, and these guys can be in another place.
Thank you.
Let's go to Chicago for line four next. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I was very interested in the relationship between group violence and alcohol, and you mentioned that this started out with sports hooliganism, and I think you mentioned once before about the drinking. I'm just wondering, how much is alcohol used as both a tool and a way to promote the group and to cement the group, and also to have a group that's fairly befuddled so that they're willing to accept simple answers?
I mean, that goes... I mean, I would only carry that argument so far. Mm-hmm. When you're at the brutal, tribal, subcultural, particularly male end of it, yes, it's there. I mean, it's there in pub culture anyway in Britain, which already has quite a large drinking, binge drinking culture. And it's there in Germany. I was on the streets of East Germany at the end of the book, probably one of the scariest places I've been. And there are extreme right-wing social clubs called the Comradeships, which are often linked at a basic level by just meeting up in a beer cellar and drinking beer. So that's part of the process, you're right. But it doesn't really answer, certainly in Europe, why you have the rise of the extreme right and xenophobic political movements, you know, which in some cases, like in Austria's case, they took 27% of the vote, the party there called the Freedom Party. The beer drinking question doesn't really touch on that, but it certainly does in the kind of gang level, the very kind of male testosterone driven groups that I visited in my journeys. Yeah, it answers some of that, and also the violence, of course.
It sort of captures the foot soldier who's not. You said that this group wasn't politically involved, and I guess my question is, once they graduate from that age group, do they later on become part of the voting public? I mean, what happens? Were you ever around any long enough to know what happens once they pass beyond the age of, you know, the good lad type of drinking?
Yeah, I mean, this might surprise you, but the gang members I originally encountered were in their mid-30s. That's my age as well. They were at that time in their mid-30s. Mm-hmm. And the leaders are obviously people who started off in their teens and stayed. What happens is, of course, if people join a gang, any kind of gang, and I've been hanging around with Bangladeshi gangs recently as part of a new project I'm doing, they're very focused on youth, and not many people stay the course for obvious reasons. They go to prison, they drop out, whatever, they grow up. But then the people who get involved in the more serious end of the politics, yes, they will graduate, if you like, and they, to some extent, have to leave some of that old behavior behind. I mean, the leader of the British National Party, the far-right political movement here, he's a Cambridge graduate. At the age of 15, he was introduced to a group here called the National Front. He was much more extreme then than he is now. Now this guy, who's in his mid-40s, wears a suit and tie. He talks the language of moderation to some extent. He says, we don't want to forcibly repatriate immigrants. We'll do it with their consent, blah, blah, blah. So these guys have learned their lesson. They've learned that if they stay hardcore, they're never going to have power. And of course, what they tell their followers is, oh, well, we're not going to get rid of the real message. We're just ameliorating our phrases for the general public so we can get votes. So that it's the wolf in sheep's clothing idea.
May I have one more question?
If you can be quick.
Okay. Well, you sort of talked about the fact what attracted people to this, and it seemed to be the loss of personal security. And in the United States, as we focus on national security, a lot of people are losing personal security, the job security, health insurance, and all of that. So does that mean that there's a breeding ground to increase the popularity of these groups as people feel this lack of personal security?
I'd really use one word to answer that, and that's fear. Fear propels a lot of these groups, not just in the extreme right, but a lot of extreme single-issue organizations of whatever kind of denomination. That's what worries me, that in the 21st century, in a world that's more interconnected than ever before, we've got such polarization of, for example, economic resources. We've got destabilization that comes perhaps with people's job insecurities. And you get nonsensical positions where, perhaps in the States, perhaps here in Britain, you've got people who will be blaming immigrants for taking their jobs, at the same time claiming those immigrants are living on welfare, at the same time as those jobs may actually even be going overseas. So people, I think, are looking for a simple answer. People are grasping. And, you know, it's no surprise you hear in the former Soviet Union, in Russia, they've got a tremendous problem with skinhead gangs there and racial violence. You hear a lot of talk about the old days of being under communism, being in the Brezhnev era, where pre-Gorbachev, where things to many people seemed certain. They weren't great, but they could rely, you know, they could rely on their pensions, their holidays, their wages, without worry. So, yeah, I am concerned for the future. I don't think anyone really knows where it's going to end up.
Well, I think we're at the point we're going to have to stop, and my apologies, we have some people we can't take. For people who are listening, if you would like to read more from our guest, again, the book is titled Into a World of Hate. The subtitle is A Journey Among the Extreme Right, and the publisher is Routledge, and our guest is Nick Ryan. He's an award-winning writer and producer. And Nick, I want to say thank you very much for talking with us today. We really appreciate you giving us some of your time.
No problem. I appreciate that. If anyone wants to know, by the way, I've got a website at nickryan.net.
Very good.
To read anymore.
So that way they can find out more about you, read some excerpts from the book, and
That's right. And go on.
Well, again, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
The broadcast today is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sports shoes, Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on the staff. And that's it for us here on Focus, but of course we want you to stay tuned here to AM 580. There is much more in the way of news and features and other things as coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Hello. Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about the story of the Pullman Porter with journalist Larry Tye. He says, if race is the story of America, the Pullman Porter represents one of its most resonant chapters. We'll talk with Larry Tye following the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look at what's happening now on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Prices are lower. July wheat, $3.34, down 5. September, $3.41.5, down 4. July corn, $2.41.5, down 3. September, $2.44.75, down 3.